Cloud. Let's see how this goes. I think we are now recording. Very good. So welcome, everyone. And I'm David Oppenheimer. I'm the director of the Berkeley Center on Comparative Equality and Anti-Discrimination Law. And part of our center is to have some working groups that work on various issues involving equality and anti-discrimination law. One of those groups is our working group on disability rights, and it is led by Gerard Quinn, who, of course, is a giant in this field. And Gerard has arranged for three webinars with really fabulous speakers today, another giant in the field, Judy Heumann. And so I'm going to just hand it off to Gerard and let him take us through the next hour. Thank you, Gerard.
Thanks, David. Hey, everybody.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Very well. Hi. How are you?
Actually, we said we'd go around the table. There's a few more to log on yet, but can you just introduce yourself, Mark, and then we'll ask Katrina to introduce her students.
Yes. So hello, everybody. Mark Bell from the Law School at Trinity College, Dublin.
Super. Katrina?
Hi, everybody. I'm Katrina Maloney, lecturer in the Centre of Disability Law and Policy here in Ireland. And with me, I have some LLM students, so I let them introduce themselves.
Hi there. So my name is Ellen Murray, and I am from Northern Ireland. I work in Cape Town.
Hi, my name is Simin Jovo, original from South Africa.
Hi, my name is Felicia. I'm from NSC County Clare.
Hi, my name is Vanessa from Mozambique.
You know, it's a little hard to understand. So maybe you could each just give your first name again a little louder.
My name is Vanessa.
Oh, Vanessa.
Yes.
Thank you.
My name is Felicia.
Felicia?
Yes, please.
Thank you.
My name is Simi.
Simi?
Yes, Simi.
Ah, thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Ellen.
Okay. Thank you.
And Katrina.
Yeah.
So we're waiting for a bunch more people to log on. We thought the way we do this is really, really informal. I might invite Judy to just give a little bit of a background or to her own life, her family, her upbringing, her education. Maybe then talk a little bit about her years of activism in and out of government, in and out of the World Bank and things like that. And then I guess what's most interesting, particularly to younger participants, is lessons learned, particularly the lessons she'd like to pass on to the next generation coming up, so to speak. But before we do that, Judy and I decided we'd just share a few reflections on a mutual colleague who's just passed away, named Marco Bristow. I don't know if any of you have heard of Marco Bristow, but we're all kind of beneficiaries of the work of Marco Bristow. She was really one of the giants of the disability rights movement in the US and took a very active role in drafting the UN Disability Treaty because she was part of Rehabilitation International delegation from the US. Judy, do you want to just share some reflections?
Sure. So Marco died on the 6th of September. She was 66 years old. She did not have her disability till, I believe it was 1977 or 1978. She dove into what she didn't realize was a shallow pool of water. She thought there was a lot of water. In fact, there were 2 feet of water. And so that's how she broke her neck. And she had been, as she describes it herself, up until that point, a very feisty young woman. She had gone to the Philippines on a scholarship that she had gotten, had some very interesting experiences in the Philippines, and really, I think at that point was learning more about some of the disparities that existed in countries between wealthier and poorer people. She herself had grown up in a rural part of upstate New York. Her father was a farmer. She had a brother and a sister. Her brother passed away a number of years in previous. And he himself was gay and had contracted AIDS. And he was a very influential person in her life because he was an activist at a time when many people in the LGBT community were not public. He was public, and he, I think, really helped reinforce who she was. She looked up to him a lot. And after she acquired her disability, she became a paraplegic, meaning she had no ability to walk and she had limited feeling, but good upper body strength. She lost her job. She was a nurse. And she started getting involved with a working group that was set up to begin to create an organization in Chicago, which was modeled after an organization in Berkeley that I was working in at that time, the Berkeley Center for Independent Living. And she was involved with a group of people setting up an organization called Access Living. And around that same period of time, the federal government in the United States passed legislation to help set up 10 centers for independent living. And the group that she was working with applied for that money, and they were one of the 10 organizations that received money. I think one of the important comments that Marka made was, as she was moving forward in this area, she of course was very uncertain. Disability was new to her. She was moving into a different field. And she said, that she felt insecure about her position, but that she didn't act that way. She acted with confidence, even when she didn't necessarily internally feel confident, which I think is a really important comment for all people. But I think one aspect of Marka that is very true is she was a strong woman as well as a strong disability rights person. And I think, her strength as a feminist also really was something that was respected by the disabled women's community. She was a civil rights leader, human rights leader. She spoke her mind. Her organization is fantastic. Organization, I would say, one of the leading centers for independent living in the United States. As Gerard was saying, she traveled to a number of countries, was involved with an organization called Rehabilitation International. She also was one of the leading forces in the United States while we were working on trying to get the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities ratified, unsuccessfully, but she was the leader of the work that was going on in the civil society. She's a wife and a mother. She had two children, one of whom is married and has a little daughter. And it was Marka, I think, really divided her life up very well. She was a very strong activist in disability, and she was very family oriented. So it was really important to her that she get to see her granddaughter, which she was able to do. But at the end of the day, Marka will really be remembered for her forthright positions on the inclusion of disabled people in all aspects of what was going on in Chicago and domestically and internationally. And I think she, like I, and I presume Gerard, feel that while we've made a lot of strides forward, we have not made the gains that we believe we should have made. And so I think, you know, part of this discussion can also really focus with those of you who are LLM students to learn a little bit about what progress you think we've made, but where we need to go and what you see as some of the barriers.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about legal history is students always think that everything goes in a straight line, whereas in fact there are lots of ziggly dots. And Mark, I believe it or not, had a big role to play in the development of European disability law. Mark will remember this well when we had the debates about the Treaty of Amsterdam and adding a non-discrimination provision. There were three or four European governments adamantly opposed, including the Danish government. So we organized a trip of senior civil servants from all around European capitals with the European Commission to Washington, D.C., while Marco was chair of the U.S. National Disability Council. And she openly and convinced many of them to go back to capital, willing to vote yes to the treaty amendment. So she had an interesting finger in lots of different pies. So over to you, Judy. Maybe we'll just lead off by your early life, your upbringing, your education, and take it from there. And by the way, we're going to leave at least 20 minutes toward the end for questions and answers. So over to you, Judy.
Someone else just joined.
Well, I heard the sound of somebody joining, but I don't see anyone that's joined.
Okay. So I'm going to be 72 years old, and I think that's important to discuss because many people don't realize that, like in the United States and in countries around the world, disability legislation has not always been in place. And so I had polio in 1949 and was living in a time when there were no disability rights laws at the national level. And I don't think there were really any major laws. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. There weren't any major pieces of legislation that addressed disability in New York or most states. So my story is probably similar to the story of some disabled people, even today, depending on the country that you're living in. When my mom took me to school in our neighborhood, the principal denied me admission because I was a fire hazard. And then I only received 2.5 hours of education until I was in the 9th grade. The Board of Education in New York City was sending a teacher to my house twice a week for a total of 2.5 hours. So I think what's always important to address around that aspect of what was going on is there was clearly no expectation that disabled children needed to have the same level of education as non-disabled children. Because clearly children going to school in New York City or wherever are getting way more than 2.5 hours a week and more than 2.5 hours a day. So what was important about that period was to see how my parents, and quite frankly, how parents in many parts of the world are beginning to understand that the expectations for their child with a disability were different, and that it was really imperative for the parents who were not advocates. And I gotta get some water, I'll be right there.
Yeah, I have coffee.
So I don't know if any of you sitting around the table in the LLM program, I don't know when, I don't know who has a disability and when you acquired it, but if any of you had yours when you were younger, be interesting to see if you have similar stories. But I think, you know, for me, it was really, as I was growing up, seeing the role that my parents played. And there's always, you know, some controversy about what is the role of parents. And for me, the role of parents has always been very important, because you need to be doing, parents need to be fulfilling their role in an age-appropriate way. But if parents are not strong advocates in the beginning, you know, if they don't believe that their child who has a disability has the right to an education, then in many cases, the child is not going to fare well in adult life. So when I got to go to school, I was in classes only for disabled children in a school that had four floors, no elevator. And except for the special ed classes, all the other children didn't have disabilities. And so you had this separation of the disabled children. But interesting enough, at the time, the classes for disabled children were racially integrated, although the classes for the non-disabled children were not. And that's a whole other interesting aspect of growing up. But discrimination is something that was not a word that was really used also in the area of disability. It's still not necessarily used the way I use it and other people use it. You know, the denial of accessible buses, of streets that are not accessible, of discrimination in education and employment, all of these barriers need to be labeled as discrimination as we're working towards the removal of those barriers. In the area of disability, I think very frequently people don't see discrimination against us the same way some people would see discrimination against other non-disabled populations. Or when they do see it, you know, like if you're from the LGBT community or a religious minority or any one of a number of other groups, there are people who will view the denial of certain opportunities as discrimination and will discuss fighting against such discrimination. But in the area of disability, certainly in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and still today, many people don't view the denial of opportunity in the area of disability as discrimination, even though we have the CRPD and national laws which define these things as discrimination. And I think that's a very important issue to be addressing, because if people understand why the denial of these opportunities is discrimination, they can take these situations more seriously. I think in many cases, people would say, oh, well, the one who is discriminating didn't understand. They didn't realize. It's kind of a demotion of the activity and really leaving it to the thought that, oh, if you give them a little more information, things will change. In some cases, that's true, but not in many cases. The evolution of, you know, my education, I went to high school. I went to a regular high school. I had a homeroom, which is where you start and end your day in the United States in high school, that was only with disabled children. And I have to say that moving from a segregated environment in elementary school, where the classes were all with disabled children, and then moving into an integrated high school was a difficult situation, because I'd been in very small classes, like 8 to 10 kids. And in New York, when I went to high school, there were like 30 to 40 children in a class. And that in and of itself was problematic for me. It was a whole, you know, continually learning how to fit in to different environments. When I was going to university and university was something that was really important. My parents talked about it. They said, you know, it's important that you go to university. You have a disability. You don't know if you're going to get married. You're going to have to support yourself. That was kind of interesting at a time period where in the United States, the role of women was changing. But, you know, when I look at my cousins, for example, some of my women cousins went to university, some didn't. Now I think that's quite changed. You know, people by and large are going on to higher education. But there were all these transitions that were happening. I wanted to be a teacher. And my friends told me, don't tell people you want to be a teacher, because the government agency that was going to help support me go to university would not support me if I wanted to be a teacher, because at that time in New York, there were no teachers that had become teachers when they were riding a wheelchair. I learned later on that there were a few teachers who were using wheelchairs, but they had acquired their disability after they were already teaching. So ultimately, I went to university. I minored in education. I went on to pursue a teaching degree and was denied my teaching degree because I couldn't walk, and decided that I would try to sue the Board of Education, and was lucky in being able to get a couple of attorneys that represented me for free, and went to court and had as the judge the first African-American woman to serve on the federal bench in the New York City area. That was pretty amazing. And ultimately, the Board of Education settled out of court. Became a teacher. I taught for 3 years. At that time, I with some friends, we set up a disability rights organization called Disabled in Action. And I eventually went on to Berkeley, study at the University of California, Berkeley, in the area of public health, and got involved with the organization called the Center for Independent Living, which was the first community-based organization run by disabled people called the Center for Independent Living. And it was cross-disability, meaning it was not just people with one or another type of disability. And right now in the United States, we have about 450 centers for independent living and an organization called the National Council on Independent Living. There's also an equivalent in Europe called the European Network for Independent Living. And the US Independent Living Movement and the European Independent Living Movement have worked together for, we're celebrating, I think, our 30th year of collaboration. That in Asia, there's an equivalent organization, which is the Japanese Coalition of Independent Living, something like that. Now, in the period of time between the 70s and today, I think one of the critical areas of growth, which I'm sure you're seeing in your countries also, has been that disabled people have been coming together to organize, and to organize both to change legislation as well as to fight for implementation. David, did they get any information in advance of today? Like the TED Talk or the Power of 504, any of that? Do you know?
They being the students in Ireland?
Yeah. Or, yeah.
You'd have to ask them.
Okay, so I'll send you, there's a number of pieces that you can look at, which are all in the public domain. One of them is called The Power of 504. If you go to YouTube, it's worth looking at because it's an 18-minute documentary about the takeover of a federal building in San Francisco in order to get the U.S. government to ratify, to sign regulations for an important piece of legislation. That's one piece that would be worth looking at. There's another one called, I don't know if you know this program, Comedy Central or Drunk History. So Drunk History is a program, you can also get their pieces online. It's called Drunk History 504. And it's also a piece, about an 8-minute piece, which is a historical piece on the 504 demonstration. So if you have like 30 minutes, I would watch The Power of 504 first, and then I would watch Drunk History. But at any rate, you can see in the 70s moving forward, there's been a growth in the disability rights movement from a human rights and civil rights perspective, where we've been working really hard on getting legislation introduced and passed to address issues of discrimination, both in the public and private sector. Okay.
So just one question arising out of that. Why public health? Why did you decide to study public health in Berkeley?
Okay, so this is a very funny story, but the truth. So I had, when you were teaching in New York at that time, you had to have a master's degree in 5 years. And I had tried to go to graduate school at Columbia University and teach, but there was no accessible transportation. And so I had to depend on friends. So I decided I would teach for 3 years and then go to graduate school. And at that point, go back into teaching, but that never happened. So I had applied to Columbia. I'd gotten accepted in community organizing and got a call one day from a man named Ed Roberts, who also is a very big figure in the United States in the disability rights movement and within the disability community internationally, saying that UC Berkeley was interested in recruiting more disabled students. And that one faculty member in the School of Public Health and one faculty member in city and regional planning were looking for students. And so they were looking to bring disabled students to Berkeley, both to study and to get involved with the Berkeley CIO. So in the 1970s, public health nor city and regional planning were very well-known fields. So I applied to city and regional planning. I was accepted. And then about 2 weeks later, I got a call and said, they'd accepted too many disabled students. What would I think about public health? So I was like, okay. Honestly, it's the best thing because I would not have liked city and regional planning. I love public health. So that is the truth on how I got accepted and why I did public health. But it was really a great decision because I love what I've learned and been able to apply.
Interesting. So maybe you could say a few words about the various campaigns you were involved in throughout the 80s and 90s, and then how you entered government into the Department of Education, the State Department, indeed the World Bank.
So I basically, from like 1970 until 1992, except for 8 months when I worked in the state government of California, I was doing work in the NGO community. As I said, I worked at the Berkeley Center for Independent Living, and then Ed Roberts and another friend and I set up an organization called the World Institute on Disability, which I think was probably the first international public policy institute run by disabled people. We set that organization up basically because public policy with a focus from a disability perspective was not really happening. And we felt that there was a lot of really great work coming out of the independent living movement, which is why we set up that organization. And then I served on quite a number of other boards in the local community and nationally, a group called the American Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. Locally, I was on the board of a group called the Over 60s Health Clinic and a women's organization. So I've always wanted to be involved locally. And I started getting involved internationally, really in the early 1970s. My parents were immigrants from Germany and things just happened. I became friends with one of the international leaders in Finland, who at the time, like me, was not an international anything. We met at a international Red Cross youth camp in Norway. His name was Kalle Kunkela. And then I met a gentleman in 1981 named Adolf Ratzka, who was German and had polio and was able to get the government to support him studying at UCLA. And so, you know, all these different things were happening. And the movement was really emerging because we were looking, you know, in 10 or 20 years, those of you who are younger will be able to have similar stories. But, you know, we look at things like television, social media, which was beginning to really emerge. Television really didn't start having an impact until the 50s and 60s around the world. But what television really allowed in the United States and other places was to get a better understanding of what really was going on within, for example, the civil rights movement in the United States, fighting against discrimination against Black Americans and the women's movement and the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War. And that was very helpful for us as we were looking at the kinds of discrimination that we were facing and trying to figure out a way to get the public more engaged to understand that these barriers existed, why they were discrimination, and what we felt needed to happen. And so that's really, we looked at what other movements were doing. We couldn't do things the same way because, you know, buses weren't accessible, sidewalks weren't accessible. Being able to do things that other people just easily took for granted, we couldn't do. So we were very inventive. And when you look at the 504 demonstrations in the power of 504, you'll see that there were about 150 people who took over a part of a building for 27 days. Now, this relates to Gerard's question, because one of the reasons we stayed in the building was because we knew that if we left the building, not only would the guards not let us back in, but the bigger question was, we probably couldn't get back because of barriers. So we decided that once we were in the building, we were not going to leave until our demand was that the government sign a set of regulations as we wanted them signed. So organizing, looking at issues around deaf people who needed sign language interpreters, blind people who needed other supports, people with physical disabilities who needed different supports, learning from each other about what discrimination meant to us as people with various forms of disabilities and the importance. And I think this is really one of the fundamental issues that not just in the US, but in every country and around the world, people have begun to recognize that we need to work together. If you've got a psychosocial disability, if you've got another form of invisible disability or visible disability, the discrimination that exists may be different, but at the end of the day, it is discrimination. And it's really imperative for us to be able to work collaboratively together and learn from each other. The CRPD, I don't know if you've studied it yet, but the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is a perfect example of how the disability community around the world had to look at coming together to agree that discrimination existed, remedies needed to be created, and we needed to be able to work collaboratively together so that we could come up with remedies that were powerful and where we weren't competing against each other. So, you know, you could do a dissertation on Gerard's question, but I think it's really a very, very, very critical issue.
So you spent a huge amount of time in activism in the community, but you also rotated into government, into the Department of Education under Clinton, into the State Department under Obama, and then laterally into the World Bank. Could you just say a few words about those different experiences?
So when President Clinton was elected, they were, for the administration, for the first time, was really looking at employing disabled people, bringing disabled people into meaningful positions in government. Marka Bristow, who we were talking about earlier, became the chairperson of something called the National Council on Disability. And I had been given a call asking if I would be interested in working full-time in the government. It was very interesting because kind of similar to the call that I got about going to UC Berkeley, I was working at the World Institute on Disability. I really had not been thinking at all about getting a job. And when they asked, I said yes, but there was only one job that I was interested in. And the job became, you would understand it, I think, as a deputy minister for, it was called the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services. And I said I had no other interest because I really, this particular part of the Department of Education dealt with early childhood, primary, secondary, parents' rights, independent living, the Rehabilitation Services Administration, which is a national program in every state dealing with employment, and something called the National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation and Research. So we had about 400 staff in 9 regional offices, and in areas that I knew both as an individual consumer of services and then working at CIL and working at the World Institute on Disability, it was kind of a natural transition. And I got that job, and it was really, it was a wonderful learning experience because it enabled me to both elevate the voices of disabled people and parents. So, you know, for example, in the United States, government agencies award money for various things, grants and contracts. And in the agency that I worked in, all of our grants were given out competitively, which meant they all had what we call peer review committees. And so I required, because I could in my position, that there be at least one disabled person on each one of the panels that we did. And then we made some adjustments also in the scoring so that the hiring of disabled people and the demonstrated ability to show how you were integrating disabled people elevated the points that you would get in the grant competition. And we worked on legislation in multiple areas. But the elevation of the voices of disabled people, I think, was very important, and on staff. So we increased the number of disabled people that we had working on our staff and the diversity, both the types of disabled people that were employed and the racial diversity of the staff. And then I think another important component was the fact that I'm a very strong networker, and you know, my goal is the inclusion of disability across the board. So both in the work that I did at Education and at the World Bank and with the State Department, focused on what I call putting a disability lens on work, where disability needs to be integrated into a broad array of activities. And that, I think, was all, you know, none of these things happened completely and still haven't. But the ability of really pushing towards disability, not as a siloed issue, but as an issue that needs to be integrated into law and housing and education, transportation, et cetera. When you look at the CRPD, you know, that is a great example of the articles within the CRPD are intended to be able to help develop strong legislation and also to deal with implementation. So I think for me, the melding of the voices of disabled people coming from civil society, understanding both domestically and internationally, because I've been doing work internationally over these years too, I think has been very helpful.
So I know we're running out of time and I want to create as much space as possible for people to make their own observations, put their own questions. But I'm just wondering, you set up the first office in the State Department advising the Secretary of State on international affairs and disability. That must have been quite something. Were you surprised? Were you shocked? Were you taken aback at the failure to ratify the CRPD by the US Senator? What were your reactions at the time?
So, I think it's important to look at the United States not from a disability lens, but in general, to have this discussion. Because many people in the United States have never traveled outside the United States. They don't view, they don't have knowledge. Let's talk now about the disability community. But in general, most people do not really have knowledge about what's going on outside of the United States. Obviously, except for people who come from other countries to live in the United States, who understand what it was like in their respective countries. But the vast majority of people, including members of the House and Senate, there are numbers of people in the House and Senate that don't have passports. So if you have members of the House and Senate that don't have passports, and I would say not the majority, but there shouldn't, it should be a zero, and it wasn't. And when you look at the fact that disabled people traveling outside of the United States was and is still difficult, so you have people who may want to be traveling outside of the U.S. who haven't. So a large part, Gerard mentioned earlier, the role that Marka was playing with the CRPD. She was working with civil society. I was working through the State Department, and we were quietly working across the board. But I firmly believe that the reason we did not ratify the treaty is because we didn't have the same knowledge, capacity, and push from the US disability community on why the CRPD should have been ratified. So we were running up against many things. One, you had opposition from the non-disability community, albeit small, but a group called the homeschoolers. They, a group of only like 100,000 people, but they came out very early on opposing ratification with all kinds of ridiculous reasons. But we did not have a machine on the ground to fight against it. Many of the years that we were working on the ratification, we were working on getting not just disabled people, but let's just talk about disabled people to understand what was the treaty, why did it matter? Because the truth is we have many laws in the United States, like the Americans with Disabilities Act and many others, and they're not perfect, but they had been more than most other countries had. So I think the excuse for the Republicans not to support the treaty, because they were not hearing strongly enough from the disability community. And it was very harsh. I mean, one of the other big problems is, while the United States does ratify treaties, it hasn't ratified many serious, you know, the Convention on the Rights of Children, others have not yet been ratified. So I think now that there really is a stronger interest in the disability community in the US about international issues, that there will be a time when we can really push this forward, but not the next 1 or 2 years.
Very much hope so. So I think now is a good time to just throw it open, and maybe we'll come back to 1 or 2 themes later on. Anybody else want to chip in, questions, observations? Is there any question you'd like to put to us, Judy? No?
Mark? Mark, your mic is off.
Thank you so much for really wonderful and fascinating insights on the development of activism. And I guess I was wondering, when the Center for Independent Living movement developed, what were its key priorities at the outset? And I wondered, have those changed over time?
So when the first center started, the Berkeley CIL, it was really somewhat modeled on a program that had started at the university called the Disabled Students Program. And the Disabled Students Program, PTSD, it was called the Physically Disabled Students Program, although it didn't just work with students who had physical disabilities. So that program was going beyond what many universities were doing. It was looking at helping students, once they'd been accepted into school, get registered, deal with all of the physical issues, because the school really was not very accessible at that time, doing things like getting their books and, you know, if you were blind, getting a reader or note taker. But what the DSP program did, which was different, is they also set up a wheelchair repair program. Because if your wheelchair broke, you couldn't go to school. And there really wasn't a lot in the community. For people who had more significant disabilities, like Ed Roberts, who had polio, as I told you, and slept in an iron lung, was a student there and needed what we call personal assistance services. And other students like myself also, when I got enrolled, they set up a registry for personal assistance. So you could go and get a list of people that had been screened, and you could interview people and hire and pay those people yourself. They were helping people learn about different benefit programs. They were helping students identify accessible housing in the community. So that program was developing, but it was only for students. And when the university found out that other disabled people, non-students, were using the services, they said that they didn't want that to happen. And that was one of the reasons for the Berkeley CIL starting. But the Berkeley CIL then and now is continuing to look way beyond services. So services is really, it was a motivating factor for setting up the organization, but advancing public policy, getting city and county and state government to be more engaged in both budgeting and putting a disability lens on the work it was doing, getting disabled people on committees. You know, for example, at that time, in the beginning in Berkeley, there were no curb cuts The buses were not accessible, you know, many, many different things. So that we got people on committees and, you know, city committees and county committees. And also, you know, we were working with not only local elected representatives, but also state representatives. And we were doing coalition work and like with the older, the aging community and other civil rights communities. So we were really, the organization was evolving as a cross disability organization, working on the development and implementation of legislation and policy, working on budgeting, allocation of funding from state, county, and city governments. And one thing that happened at that time is Ed Roberts, who was one of the founders of the Berkeley CIL and the first director, he went, someone named Jerry Brown, who became the governor of California, he offered Ed a job heading up the California Department of Rehabilitation. And the California Department of Rehabilitation also oversaw the money from the federal government that enabled him to set up in California only 10 centers for independent living. So when I mentioned MARCA and in 1978, the work that was going on nationally, in California, we already had 11 centers for independent living, and we already had gotten legislation passed in our state legislature, which was separate legislation, funding centers for independent living before the federal government was out of the gate. And actually the Berkeley Center for Independent Living was where the federal hearings were held that supported the development of a provision in the rehab legislation to put money for the 10 centers. So you'll see around the country that the stronger centers are very much continuing to do a combination of work and also doing cutting edge work. So there's an organization in the United States called the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, and it was a spinoff out of the CIL in Berkeley. We had a paralegal program, which then became a separate organization, Greta. So I would say that these, the development of the voices of disabled people, and you've got them in Ireland. You've got a number of centers for independent living in Ireland that I believe have been doing similar work as in, you know, Scandinavia and various parts of Europe itself. So I think we've all found that, you know, in order for disabled people, for some disabled people to be able to really engage in the community, we have to look at the barriers. And the barriers for some people go back to needing support services, needing accessible housing, needing, like it was in the Bay Area, we had some of the first really strong demonstrations to get transportation accessible. So the train system, when it was built in the early 70s, was sued and became accessible. The buses were beginning to become accessible in 75, 76, and 77, again, because of this work that the CIL in Berkeley and others were doing, suing county governments, working with legal aid and others to be able to get this work done. So I call it, you know, coming together to go apart. We were able to come together to describe the problem, describe what we wanted, and we did great networking at any place that we could and still do to really pull these forces together.
So Judy, Mark, and I last year were involved in a project on independent living in the European Union. And one of the worst offenders is, believe it or not, the Republic of France. They spend a lot of money on institutions, which is incredible. Right. Sorry, David, did I interrupt?
It occurs to me, Judy, you've been a litigant suing the New York School Board, and you've been a community organizer, and you've been an insider in government in making law. I think everyone else on this call is a lawyer or is training as a lawyer. So how do you see the role of lawyers in this movement?
I think lawyers are pivotal, you know, because for many, many reasons, not just the larger ones that I was discussing, but in anything from benefits that government has policy, laws and policy on that you may not be able to access without not necessarily representation from a lawyer, but a lawyer or someone with that kind of knowledge, being able to help you understand what you're eligible for. I think, you know, lawyers clearly, when you need to go to court, are very important, because if you don't have knowledgeable representation, then litigation can be harmful. And I think that's one of the things that we were seeing after the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed in the early 90s, is that lawyers were getting involved in litigation that, you know, probably those of us around this Zoom lens would not have thought was the best litigation to start with. But lawyers are essential. Lawyers, I think many lawyers think in a way that's really critical to being able to help not only implement legislation, but also to be able to develop legislation and to be able to develop rules and to be able to represent people and to train people. So I think, you know, disability is still not yet central enough, I think, in many of the trainings that law students get. And when we look at diversity and discrimination, disability is still not on the table in an equal way to race discrimination or sexual orientation or gender. And so I think that's another problem, but I think it's critical.
Wonderful. And Judy, you've always been telling me that you never go into a minister seeking an answer. You already have the answer worked out before you go into the minister.
I mean, you absolutely have to know what you want.
Yeah.
And you have to really understand what they may say to you. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to talk about why what they're saying is wrong. Or, you know, there are sometimes where there are legitimate issues where we haven't come to agreement on. But the question for me is, and it was one of the things that I really saw when I was working in the Department of Education, because each one of my government jobs and, you know, the World Bank job, they've all been different. I've had different levels of responsibility. I would say in education, I had the most authority because 400 staff, about $10 billion in funds, and we had responsibility nationally. And when we were working on reauthorization of a very important piece of education legislation, getting the Department of Education to work with lawyers and advocates from outside of government was a challenge, because people were not used to really sitting down and having meaningful discussions, you know, because there are all these rules, which I don't disagree with. You know, many of the rules are done to ensure that insiders and outsiders, you know, aren't being given undue access to people when others aren't. But I think we were ultimately able to really get people to sit down with lawyers and advocates and parents, who in some cases were advocates, some cases lawyers, some cases both, to really understand the reality of what was going on in the field, what is going on in school districts. And you really need to have a better understanding of what really is going on to be able to look at what needs to be done, and how when you're moving forward with legislation, you want to make sure that you're, in my view, not wasting your time. So you really want to be looking at critical issues that, if you're able to make a change, will make advancement. So just really briefly, one thing that we spent time on was the issue of inclusion of disabled children in school, and that disabled children also would be a part of the testing. that goes on, because we were seeing that children were being excluded from many of these processes, subsequently not looking at their whether or not they were making progress, which meant that teachers weren't necessarily trained, and on. So, yeah.
I'm just wondering, Katrina, do any of your students wish to raise a point? Ellen, Vanessa, Felicia?
Oh, come on, guys, you must have a question.
My interest is on inclusive education, because one of the big problems that we have in Mozambique is access to education to children with disabilities. So if you had to, for example, advise me, imagine I want to go back home and impact some difference. If you have to give me some steps to change or to have this inclusive education or mainstream schools, what would you say to me?
So I would say, look at whether or not your government has legislation in the area of education for disabled children. I would take the time when you're in school right now to analyze the legislation and to see where the strengths and weaknesses in that legislation are. I would look at whether or not there are any parent organizations that are involved in helping to get children included in school, whether there's any training that's going on of parents about what their rights are. I'd look at whether or not any of the disability organizations in Mozambique are including disability in the work that, I'm sorry, including education of disabled children, because I think many of us know, like the Berkeley CIL, when I first got there, the people who were involved were mainly people, mainly, not exclusively, but mainly people who had acquired their disabilities when they were teenagers or older. So they had no experience in what it was like for kids to be denied the right to go to school, to be sent to special education classes. So we needed to help educate them to also see that the advocacy they were doing needed to expand down to the younger children community and working with parents and youth themselves. I know that Rosangela Berman Beeler, who is the focal point at UNICEF, UNICEF has been doing work in Mozambique. So I would see if you knew about that, and if not, what you could learn about it. And I would also, you know, Ireland's got some very good programs that are addressing issues of inclusive education. So I think, when do you leave? When are you finished with your program?
Next year.
Okay, so I would see if you couldn't, you know, meet with some parent groups, meet with, you know, organizations that are doing work on inclusive education, look at the law that they've got in Ireland, compare it to what you've got in Mozambique. Look at enforcement, to me, is always very important. So are there provisions in the Irish law? You could also look at the US law, and in the law that you have in Mozambique. So what does it say about enforcement? So, and not only what does it say, but what are they doing? I look at things like, is the responsibility for education of disabled children under the Ministry of Education, or is it in another ministry? Because that's something that also frequently happens, that education for disabled kids is not in the Ministry of Education. And whereas that's not the be all and end all solution, if the Ministry of Education doesn't have responsibility for education of disabled children, then, and it's in another ministry, it will be very difficult to make anything happen. And then I think, you know, one thing that also was very important, and I mentioned this a couple of times, as disabled people, we need to be talking about why education is important, what programs did we go to, what worked, what didn't work. You know, I mentioned that when I went to high school, it was a very difficult transition because I'd been in a segregated program. I hadn't been learning the same thing as other kids were learning. When I went to high school, it made it more difficult. So, you know, why is inclusive education important? Being able to specifically and clearly discuss that, having adults who've been through the inferior system is also very important. It's kind of, you know, I always think, what is this other person going to be thinking? You know, what are they going to argue with you? Our teachers aren't trained. And parents will say, appropriately so in some cases, we don't want our children just being thrown into a classroom. We want to make sure they're getting services. But, and then I'm always happy to talk to you offline.
So I'm going to just ask David to wind up shortly because I know time is of the essence for you, David. But just before I do, could I invite you, Judy, to just reflect on what's the big lesson in terms of change, dynamics of change? What's the one thing, okay, maybe two things you want to pass on to the next generation?
First, I think we need to work intergenerationally. I think it's really important that younger and older people who have different experiences be able to work together on a regular basis. I think the other thing is change doesn't happen overnight. And we really have to recognize that. And, you know, one of my experiences, and this is certainly not just my experience, I'm sure, it's your experiences that you'll see as you get older. But when we started working in the disability rights movement, I defined it as kind of being in a candy store. And the reason I defined it as being in a candy store was because we had so many problems, right? You go in the candy store, you can have 10, 15, 20, 50 different types of candy. You've got a certain amount of money that you can spend and you just decide what to take or what to buy. That's what it was like in the beginning of the movement. You know, we were all generalists and we needed to move beyond being generalists. We knew the problem. We knew the impact of the problem. We knew what we wanted. But for example, when we were fighting for accessible transportation, there were really very few people from within the disability community who really understood the technical issues of buses. So we needed to be able to expand the circle, really learn about how buses could be made accessible, why there was opposition. And that's where lawyers came in too, because there were numerous pieces of litigation. And you can just multiply it over and over again. But look at who are the disabled people going to universities? What are they studying? I think it's really important that, A, we recognize that many disabled people, I don't care where you live, are still not comfortable in identifying as a disabled person. And that really has been a problem. We really need to allow disabled people to recognize that when we talk about 1 billion disabled people, if 100 million, if 50 million, if 30 million disabled people around the world really focus on advancing the inclusion of disabled people, we would be further ahead. So I think we cannot avoid really doing local work, getting disabled people to talk amongst ourselves, to look at how to throw off the shame of disability and the fear of repercussions when one identifies as a disabled person.
Great. So from one Berkeley advocate back to...
But actually, I have to say, I am the way I am because I'm from Brooklyn.
Oh, there you go. Brooklyn, Berkeley. David, do you want to wrap up?
I can't hear you.
New York and Berkeley are a good combination.
Brooklyn.
So, thank you so much, Judy. Thank you so much, Gerard, for organizing this. Thanks to all of you who joined us today. And we'll be back. What's the date, Gerard, for our next?
You know I'm bloody bad at dates, but the next one is being given by Janet Lord. And it's about a recent project we have, which is on the laws of war and protecting civilians with disabilities during armed conflicts. Unfortunately, a very topical issue around the world at the moment. So that's sometime in November.
Monday, November 18th.
There you go.
Very good. And thank you again to all of you for joining us today. I'm now going to end the recording.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Bye.